say good morning to everyone.
Morning.
Morning.
Beautiful, beautiful responses. I am Leslie Speller Henderson, and I am actually your moderator this morning. That's probably later or another day. You are in the barriers. That's what I'm doing here. Barriers to Food Access in Middle Tennessee session. Is that correct? Everyone's in the right seat, right place. The ears are open. We're here to talk about, and I like the statement. Do you know that in some Nashville neighborhoods, you are 10 times as likely to see tobacco as a tomato in a food store? And I venture to say probably more neighborhood stores, community stores. And I don't know if I'll pick on tomato. And maybe a banana, maybe a carrot, maybe some celery, something simple, maybe even some lemons. But also, in keeping with the what did Cassie say earlier, food, being involved with food is an agenda for change. So staying in that vein of what's happening around food, look at the barriers. You need to think about, is it a barrier to availability? Is it available a barrier to affordability? Is the barrier to desirability? And we're going to look at that. We have three panelists who are going to come to us from, I'm thinking, three different directions, right, ladies? Okay. Our first speaker is Darcy Freeman. And because I know everyone in here can read, and we need to open our agenda and look through it sometimes, our book, we have the bios for all three of our wonderful panelists, Darcy Freeman, Sandrea Godwin, and Flora Wilson, speaking in that order, in our book. So, without further ado, should we get started?
Great. Good morning. How are y'all doing today?
Good.
I can't just sit, so I have to stand. Hopefully it will catch up on that recorder. But to get started today, I want everybody to close your eyes for a moment. And I want you to think about some questions that I'm going to propose to you, and think about your own situation, your own life, and how you would answer these. Where do you purchase your food? What does this store look like? And what types of food items are available for purchase in that store? Is it clean? What does it smell like? Does it have a section with a wide variety of fresh fruits and vegetables? Can you buy whole grain or low-fat milk products in that store? How did you get to your store? Did you walk? Did you drive your own private transportation? Did you hire a taxi? Did you ride the bus? Did you ride your bicycle? How did you pay for your food? Did you open up your wallet and pull out cash? Did you use your credit card or your EBT or WIC card? How does your food compare to other food stores in our city? Is it the same? Is it different? Is it better? Is it worse? Why does your food store look the way that it does, and perhaps another person's look differently? So go ahead and open your eyes. I want you just to think about your frame of reference as we think about the story that I'm going to paint today about some communities in Nashville that may or may not resonate with your own personal experience. Did you know that in the United States, about 1 in 10 people are food insecure? And food insecure is essentially being unable to provide for your food needs. That 1 in 8 infants in the United States live in households that have food insecurity. And among low-income families, about 30% of infants live in homes that do not have the food needs to provide for the children as well as for the adults in the home. In our own community in 2004, about 14.5 million pounds of food were given away by Second Harvest alone. That's just one of many food banks in our community. And in 2005, one rescue mission gave over 500,000 meals away to people in need of food. When we think about food insecurity on a broad level, it's really helpful to think about any sorts of patterns that occur. Because if you can identify patterns, you can also find ways to possibly interrupt those patterns. So some of the patterns that we see with food insecurity on a national level include these here. So at the national level, about 11% of people are food insecure. This is measured by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We see that households living below the federal poverty line, so that an economic status, a low income, have a lot higher levels of food insecurity, greater than 35%. More than three times the rate of food insecurity than the average person in the United States. Single female-headed families also have very high rates of food insecurity. Black and Hispanic households have very high rates of food insecurity. And interestingly, for all of us in this room living here in Nashville, Tennessee, or the Middle Tennessee region, the southern region of the United States has some of the highest rates of food insecurity compared to any other region in the country. So what I'm going to talk to you today about very briefly, but really only as a tool to open up more discussion, is to look at five communities in our city, in Davidson County. All of these communities have a Boys and Girls Club. And what we did with students in two different classes at Vanderbilt is we went out and actually looked at what sorts of food stores are available within a 1 mile radius of these five different Boys and Girls Clubs. Just to give you a feel for the communities where the Boys and Girls Clubs are located, you can see across the bottom here are the names of the five different Boys and Girls Clubs. And these different bars tell you the percentage of people in these areas that experience poverty. The purple bar represents for all families. So you can see, compared to the county as a whole, all of these areas have higher percentages of people living in poverty than our county as a whole. But I think it's really interesting to also look at how much more poverty is affecting single female-headed families in our community, our very own community right here in Nashville. So that the people experiencing the greatest amount of poverty tend to be these places where they're women that have the responsibility of raising children and their families on their own and figuring out the best way to make ends meet in that situation. In these communities, I think it's also really interesting to think about how are people able to move around in the community? So in Davidson County as a whole, a very small percentage of the population relies on public transportation as their primary means of transportation. However, in the communities where these Boys and Girls Clubs are located, you can see that a pretty high number of people do not have their own private transport. So that means when they're going to get food, they're going to have to take the bus or walk or hire a taxi or get a ride from a friend if they're going to go, if the resources aren't right there in the neighborhood. When we did this food auditing project, we looked at four different kinds of places to get food. Supermarkets, which were chain stores that sell a wide variety of food, such as Kroger. Local markets that also sell a wide variety, but you know the quality may vary, and these are not chain markets. Convenience stores, such as a gas station, and then fast food restaurants, and we all know what a fast food restaurant is. So in these five different communities, there were a total of 106 stores, and you can see that these two together, the yellow and the green, were the most. Yellow represents convenience stores. Green represents fast food restaurants. Of all the food stores in these communities, less than 4% of the stores, four total actually, were supermarkets, large chain supermarkets. So what do they sell in these stores? They don't sell a lot of what I have up here, fresh fruits and vegetables, but just to give you an example, only 7% of all 106 stores sold grapes, 22% sold apples, 25% sold bananas, with bananas being the most popular fresh fruit in the stores. Vegetables. less than 10% sold carrots, right at 10% sold tomatoes, and 12% sold lettuce. So you can see here, if you walked in that store, and back to those questions again, and imagining where you're shopping, if you're shopping in these stores, you're not going to see a lot of green tomatoes, or red tomatoes, or carrots, or bananas even. I think it's also really important to note that while it was not selling a lot of fresh and healthy foods, there was a plethora of unhealthy items. 90% of the store sold alcohol, and 80% sold tobacco products. So you could go in there and you could have any variety of cigarettes you've ever thought you could ever need. Any variety of beer, high grade, low grade, that you ever could imagine needing is available in these communities. And so, you know, the question is, are these areas that are food oases or food deserts? And I think, you know, I talked to somebody last April about what is it like to be in a community in a food desert? What is that experience like? And I asked her to imagine herself experiencing having very limited access to food. And she told me about a story where she was driving right out of college 25 years ago across the country and was in the middle of Arizona, literally in the desert. And she and her sister were dying of heat. You can imagine the heat in Arizona in the summertime. And they were so hot, all they wanted to do was get water and stop at a convenience store, get some water and pour it on their head. And they finally found a convenience store in the middle of the desert, and they went in and they didn't sell water. The only thing they could find in the store that would soothe their need, which was heat at that point in time, was a 2-liter bottle of Sprite that was being refrigerated. And so what did they do? They went in the store, they bought a 2-liter bottle of Sprite, and they poured it on their heads because they were so hot. And so that, you know, somebody made this face like, ugh, how could you ever do that? That's going to be sticky and messy and ugh. But when you're in a situation, when you're in this desert environment, it's very easy to do things that you would not really want to do. But at the same time, you've got to meet a need. And sometimes we do things that aren't necessarily the best things. The most important thing that I want to say right now is that this is not about putting up a story and saying, you know, times are bad, guys, and let's just suck it up, and just it's a horrible situation, and let's all go home. But rather to say there is something that we can do about it. And in these five communities, what we did this past summer and what will continue again this summer was the establishment of farmers markets. You can see the variety of foods here. These are not wimpy-looking fruits and vegetables. These are very high-quality, organic, Tennessee-grown products that found their way into the community. It was a way to support 13 local farmers and at the same time to provide fresh and healthy food to over 500 families living in the communities near the Boys and Girls Clubs. So that was the Veggie Project. And what I hope we can do in our conversation today is to think about the reality of our communities and who does and does not have access to food. But more importantly, to think about what it is that we as community members can do, because there is something that we can do about it, and it's about working together to make that change. So with that, I will close. Thank you.
All right. Good morning again. You've heard that a lot today already. One of the things that's rather interesting, I think, in all this work is this term of partners, because it's just fascinating to me that a lot of us have the same interest, have been doing similar things for years and years and never knew about it. Our work at Tennessee State University with food security goes back about 7 years ago, when we actually got a phone call from Carol Miller at Second Harvest, and she said, "Don't you want to come over here and work with us on a project?" And Leslie was working with me at the time in research, and we unfortunately have this habit of not being able to say no. And so, but this turned out to be one of those good cases, like, "Boy, I'm sure glad we said yes." And she said, "We have this meeting, and we'd like for you to come over and interview our participants." So we quickly put together, you know, some kind of instrument. And that kind of started our you know, vision and journey into this process. Because at that time, we were talking to the people who worked at the Second Harvest Food Banks. And we asked them, you know, what their perceptions were of what was being provided and what were the needs of their needs and the needs of the people that came to the food banks. That led to one of our first studies, which was actually assessing the food security status of people in Middle Tennessee and all the surrounding counties that Second Harvest of Middle Tennessee actually serves. And so we got similar statistics to what Darcy was presenting, and that was that the situation of food security status of people in Middle Tennessee is much worse than, you know, what you see on a national level. Now, I'm not going to talk specifically about what we found in those particular studies, but we do have publications from by once, and you can give Debbie's with me today, and that's, this isn't the one, it's a different one. If you give her name and address, we've got those publications we can send you. What we're going to talk about a little more today is then we said, you know, if there is a problem, you know, what is leading to that problem? And we're particularly interested in fruits and vegetables because that, of course, we all know is the healthiest thing that we can eat. So we decided to address that. So we've done it through numerous ways. And one was, you know, to find out what their perceptions were of the barriers that they're facing in getting access to fresh fruits and vegetables. And then hopefully finding out, you know, if their perception is correct in a lot of cases. And so we did two studies I'll talk about first, then we'll switch over to something totally different towards the end. We did focus groups. You know, we brought people in and literally asked them what are the barriers. And, you know, we do it in about a two-hour session, and we'll talk about some of those just shortly. And then we did surveys. We've actually done surveys of about 264 people in the Middle Tennessee area, asking them, you know, if they'd had fruits and vegetables the day before we talked to them, and if not, you know, what were some of the reasons that they felt that was keeping them from having the fruits and vegetables. So first of all, these are some of the barriers that were expressed. Some are kind of fun, but, you know, the number one we get is that they're expensive. And so, you know, as a teacher, I teach dietetic students, I teach, you know, the nutrition classes, and I spend an awful lot of time trying to dispel that myth, because I said, you know, that's a whole lot cheaper than those potato chips and soda pop that you're walking in my class with. And so, you know, but a lot of people say that. Most people just say they really don't even know what to do with them. Unfortunately, the number one reason is they just don't like them. And that was, you know, I just don't like them. I don't know what to do with them. Some of these are even fun, though. Somebody told me they weren't good for me. I can't imagine who told anybody that, but because obviously that's not what we teach. And then, of course, you know, not available where they're shopping, or what is there is not, doesn't look very good, not very good quality. And so we proceeded after that to say, well, let's go look at, you know, someone, the quality that is out there and what fruits and vegetables are available in the stores. And, you know, that we're kind of real, we follow pretty strict, rigid research protocols. We went actually on a computer program that supposedly has all the stores listed that want to be listed in this program. And we wanted all of the stores that were in 1 mile of a food box distribution, because that's where we started this, was working with Second Harvest. And we've kind of thought that, you know, if people really wanted to get something, they should be able to walk a mile. Especially when we see what our next speaker is going to talk about. They should be able to walk a mile, shouldn't they, Ms. Flora?
Yeah, I think so.
And so we said, we'll go, you know, what's within a mile of these places that they come to now to get food boxes? So we know they have a way to get there. And so we had a really complicated checklist that we went into these stores and actually assessed, not just fresh fruits and vegetables, but canned fruits and vegetables, dried fruits and vegetables, and the kinds and types and prices and just all kinds of information. So there is an article that Debbie was distributing. I don't know if y'all got it or not. If you did not, just let her know. that actually has all this specific information in it, because there's a lot more there than I'm going to present today. And so we went into 50 stores. Now that sounds easy, maybe, and then Darcy might attest to this. I don't know what barriers they faced to going into the stores even. But what we found interesting was that some people didn't want you in their stores. And I always find that fascinating. I said, wait a minute. You know, these are potential people that are going to come here and buy food at your store, and you're telling them they can't come in here and see what you have. And so we did have, you know, people turned us down, wouldn't let us come in and see what they had. So that's kind of fascinating to me. We, out of the 50 stores, only 31 of them had any fresh fruits and vegetables at all. So similar story. Lot more, you know, prevalence of canned, but we were kind of surprised that all of them didn't even have a canned fruit or vegetable in them. Now that was really interesting. We have been working with a friend of mine that runs the Delta of Nairi Project, and I don't know if you've heard of that or not, but they've been doing this kind of assessment for years. And she had been telling us that down in the Delta, Mississippi Delta area, you can't go in a store and find a fruit or vegetable, so us being out there telling them they need to eat more is kind of irrelevant because they can't find them anyway. And so here we were saying, you know, 8 of the stores we went to didn't even have a canned fruit or vegetable in them. Frozen was even less common. Only 18 of the 50 stores had a frozen fruit or vegetable. And then the ones that were available, our results were a little bit different than what Darcy's group found. The most common was apples in the ones we went to. 28 of the stores did have apples. Bananas, next most common, so that did match hers. And then one that kind of surprised us was tangerines. 15 of them had tangerines. And then lemons were most often found in the ones that called themselves grocery stores, but actually were more of a liquor store type setting that had a little bit of produce over here on the side. So that's where the lemons were. And then the fresh vegetables, lettuce, of course, is number one. Cabbage, bell peppers. What we were kind of surprised at was potatoes, which I would think would be the number one staple item that people would be interested in purchasing. Only 15 of the stores actually had even a potato. And then here's that information you heard about the tomato. Now, our percent was a little higher. 15 of the 50 stores actually had tomatoes in them. And then we kind of looked at canned fruits, fruit cocktail in a little over half the stores, peaches, 19, down to mandarin oranges. Now there was a lot, in some cases there were some other fruits there, we just went with the most common, like there might be one store that had something really strange like canned grapes, why they had those. And then the canned vegetables, green beans, not surprisingly, number one, which is unfortunate because it's not the best choice. What I was really surprised at was asparagus. But, you know, the asparagus had been sitting on that shelf for a long time. So that means it's been purchased. That's probably why it's still there and why so many of them still had it. But there again, down to even canned tomatoes, which are one of the better choices if you're going to do canned fruits and vegetables, that to pick is pretty low, only 18 of them. Kind of a similar result there. We continue to collect all kinds of data like that. But last year, I've met with my team. We function in teams at TSU. And I said, you know, we've been collecting data. We know the situation's bad. It's kind of like Darcy says, we know it's bad. So why do we want to just keep collecting data to make us know it's bad? We already know that. So finally got to be involved in a project that we just fell in love with. Some of you may know Sean Seipel, who at the time was with TARP, probably officially, and then he switched over to Good Food for Good People, and of course Nashville Farmers Market. And we sponsored this program, and then Debbie Collins-Biggs, one of my students, actually worked with Sean on the project, and then Natalie came along and helped us with some of the interviews later. And, you know, we said we want to do something about getting what is available to the people. But the difference between this project and, of course, the one Darcy was talking about is we're taking food that was considered inedible and distributing it to people, who could still eat it. Now, this is really a two-part project. I'm going to be reporting statistics from the first, from the actual part where we distributed the food, and I'll tell you the other fun part of it at the end. Purpose was to divert these distressed fruits and vegetables out of the waste stream. And literally, what happened was, is Sean and his crew, and sometimes Debbie was with them, go to the farmer's market and they pick up these boxes of food that would be thrown away normally into the garbage can. And then they take them to the truck and they go through them. And it's, you know, it's not a very scientific method. It's like, this one looks like it's still edible, this one doesn't. And so we kind of split them out that way. Sometimes the one he brought over that I looked at that he thought was edible, I was going, I don't think I'd eat that. But that's kind of what they did. The ones that were not considered edible still went into the compost truck, and that was taken down to the Tennessee State University farm, where it was then taken out to Cheatham County and is now compost. So, in case, you know, Debbie put the gleaning definition up here for you. So collecting things that might be discarded normally and salvaging them. Okay, and so it's hard to estimate really how many people that are served, because literally there were two basic distribution methods. And one is that he takes his veggie van. Unfortunately, this wasn't Sean's van, but we're going to try and figure out how to get some tomato wheels for his. So his will be just as cute as this one. He said he couldn't find the picture last night. But he's estimating that he gave food away to approximately 1,000 people. And then in talking to many of those people, he said that, you know, many of them share it with other people. So wild estimate, about 1,000 people to up to 1,500 people. Individuals received the food, and then it was also distributed sometimes to food kitchens and some of the other places that are up here. So literally drive around, open the back of the van, and hand out food is literally how it's done. Okay. So when we started hearing some of the results, and the interesting thing of this is only the results of what he got at Farmer's Market that we participated in. He was also getting food from other places, and so those numbers are totally different, not included in here. Number one food that was distributed was watermelon. Now, this is by weight, and that's just because they weigh a whole lot more anyway. And so approximately 18,000 pounds of watermelon was distributed to people. The next most common was cantaloupe, and about 7,000. Squash, 6,400. Tomatoes, about 5,000 pounds of tomatoes. I'll come back and talk about tomatoes a little bit. And down through corn, cucumbers, peppers, green beans, peaches, okra, cauliflower, cabbage, peas, all kinds of yummy looking stuff. I was giving Debbie a hard time though. I said, Debbie, these don't look very distressed. So I said, we couldn't find real good pictures of things that looked like they were almost bad. So
yeah, people don't like to publish ugly pictures.
Yeah, they don't like to post ugly pictures. So it's kind of hard to, you know, tell for sure how much this project, you know, is worth, how much, but Sean tells me to use a conservative estimate of 75 cents a pound for the produce that was distributed. So we've, you know, calculated that he actually gave away 44,453 pounds of food this last past summer at an estimated value of $33,339. Fabulous. We were thrilled. He also diverted 39 tons of waste, which benefited Second Harvest in that they didn't have to pay for hauling fees and disposal fees and the gas to do that, and they did fund part of this project also. And now we have 25 yards of we had this long description on there. What was it? Highly fertile something,
highly
something,
fertile,
you know, compost.
Yeah.
So we shortened that to of compost. And so somewhere around $35,000-$36,000 benefit to this project. We actually spend about $11,000 total doing the project. So I mean, it's not something you just go out and do. And unfortunately, most of that money went to gas. And then the side benefits that are, you know, unexpected. This is the favorite part sometimes for us because we're very community oriented. Is that, you know, people sort of started taking a personal, you know, buy-in on this. They wanted to help if they could. And so they were bringing their recyclable plastic bags and giving them to him, and that was nice. They were offering funds. Now, I don't mean big funds, $1 for gas, but for people that don't have money, $1 is a lot of money. And so they wanted to be sure that he could still come back when the gas was going up in price. And then, of course, you know, some people took some to people who, you know, could not actually literally walk to the van. I didn't put the negatives up here if you want to know those. We can talk about those because, you know, everything's not rosy. You know, Sean's wife almost got trampled. as people literally grabbed the bag so quick she fell out of the van and they were running over her. So, you know, you got a little bit of caution here sometimes, too. What I did not put up here was the other part of the study we did, because the first question that happened as we started this project, people said, aren't you afraid to give away rotten fruits and vegetables? And we said, hey, we got a food micro lab. We're going to go find out if they're still really edible. And the good news is, and what happened was we brought in the things he was giving away, the free stuff. Then we purchased what would have been considered the still sellable items of equal, you know, type. And with the exception of the tomatoes, there's no significant difference in the microbial content. So those that we were giving away were just as safe to consume, yet they didn't look pretty. It was the only thing bad about them. Now, we are going to caution people about the tomatoes, though. There was a difference. So we're definitely, if we do this, we're going to do it again this summer, but we give away a food safety brochure, and we're going to say, definitely only use these tomatoes in something that you cook, because the tomatoes were highly, you know, they were up to the, they're barely passing when it came to the bacteria levels. So we're doing that project too. So great project. We had a good time presenting this all over the nation and the world this year. So it's kind of exciting. So I think that was it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Ms. Flora.
Share with you.
Oh, I don't go down, up and down too good, but I am up now. And I'm going to talk about my life. I was raised in the country, in the farm, a little small town in Louisiana called Opelousas. Most people think there's only two cities in Louisiana, Baton Rouge and New Orleans, but that's a lot of small cities, little towns. And we were raised on the farm. We were poor when we were coming up, but we didn't know it because everybody was in the same shape. And I don't feel like we missed anything. And we had two wonderful parents. It was eight children to grow up. I had a brother and a sister died at infants, 6 months and 18 months. We walked to school the last 2 years, 8 miles one way. We had books, heavy books. The last 2 years of my high school, I rode a bicycle. Our means of transportation then was horse and buggy, a wagon. It was about four people in the whole community that had cars, and if you had to go far, they would take you somewhere. Gasoline might have been 10 cents a gallon or something like that. We raised everything. So it wasn't any problem of going to the store to buy fruit and vegetables because we raised all of that, including butter. A meal, with the meal, we had chickens, and they would take the corn to the meal and crack it. You would sift that for the small chickens and you use the other part as meal. So we raised sugar cane. We had our own syrup meal. And so we didn't know anything about buying stuff. We didn't have freezers then, so we canned everything. And we had a wonderful life. Our father made sure we went to church. You didn't go out on Saturday night and couldn't go to church. You might have slept all during the service, but you did set up in church, you know. And we went to school. And my two older brothers went in service in order to help the other ones be able to go to college. So we have always been a sharing family, and everybody knew everybody in the community. If something happened, if somebody got sick, your neighbors come in, and I experienced that in 03. When I went through cancer, my neighbor stepped in. Family couldn't have done what they did. I mean, when I would go to the doctor, five or six would go with me, and Miss Brenda know that, you know, they just came and we just was right there. And when they discharged me in 03, October, they told me I had 3 to 6 months to live. But they forgot about where I come from. My family is long livers. So, you know, I wasn't getting ready to go anywhere. And right now, I'm cancer-free, and I never... And, when I went in, I was at stage 4. I had 3% blood in me because I was taking care of my sister. I knew I had it for 2 years, but it was just the two of us here. My brother in Atlanta, his wife was sick. My sister in New Jersey had hip replacement. My other sister had to help take care of her, so my neighbors stepped in. I mean, they even tried to make an invalid out of me. They would come home and do this, that, and the other. I wasn't used to that. So I just told them, you know, I'm not an invalid yet. And everything worked out real good. And I have, and we raised everything. Now, okra at home was this long, but it was tender. You raised everything. You raised your, you made your own syrup. They had, my uncle had mules that would go around and squeeze the juice out of it, and it take about 2 weeks to cook it into the syrup. It is.
Now that you're in the city, away from home, how's that changed your ability to get food? I mean, before your food was there for you in the garden, you grew everything you needed. Now, how's that changed?
It's when I first come, it made a big difference, because we wasn't used to buying anything, and the stuff at home, it grew. When I first come to Nashville, and my sister got some greens, well, I threw most of it away because they were so small. We were used to large leaves of green, and she had to go back and get the stuff I threw away to make a meal, because it's just the way it grows. And we didn't use any fertilizer. We grew everything, popcorn, peanuts. We raised everything. And it's different. We have more or less fruits. I mean, vegetables the year round. We raised all type of fruits, and we can, as I said, we can, because we didn't have freezers. And it was a wonderful life. And we were raised to help other people. When we finished our crop, we would go and help the other people. It wasn't for pay. Now, the only way you can insult a person in Louisiana, if you refuse to eat when they fix you a meal. Because they believe in feeding you. There were no obese people when we were coming up. Because you walked, you was active. There wasn't television, so you didn't sit down and watch television. And I'll never forget, my daddy's favorite television program was Stella Dallas and Our Gal Sunday. Some kind of program that he would stop. When he was working in the field, he would come home at from 11:30 to 12 to watch, to hear his programs on television. So we've always been, used to sharing and respect everybody. We didn't have to worry about doing anything wrong, because if our neighbors saw, we'd rather our parents see us do something, because we were getting it from them, from home, and everywhere. And I think it's funny, and I tell these children, you don't know what a hard day's work is. We was working in the country, on the farm. We would go out and we'd work 5 days a week for $3 a day. At the end of the week, we had $15. We could do more with $15 then than we can do with $1,500 now. My father's sisters, they sold a lot. So we got Sears Roebuck and Montgomery Ward catalog, and we would look in there and see what we wanted. They would take newspapers, cut a pattern, and you couldn't tell it wasn't something we bought in the store. So I think being poor coming up helped me live in today's world and learn how to appreciate people and, you know, just everything. So it was enjoyable. I enjoyed it. And whatever I can do to help anybody now, I don't mind doing it.
How do you grow popcorn?
Just like you do regular corn.
So what makes it popcorn?
Because the kernels are smaller.
Oh, there's actually a different corn.
They're very small. Peanut grows under the ground. You dig those up and you put them out and let them dry. And it's very easy. It's not hard to grow at all.
Do you garden at all today?
Yes, I'm with the Edge Hill Garden. Uh-huh.
I have a question. You said your family has a lot of long livers in it.
Yes.
As the lifestyle of your family has changed from the farming-based sort of family lifestyle to living in the cities.
Yes, some of it have.
Have you noticed an increase in the rate of... You said nobody was obese when you were young.
Very, very few.
Have you noticed more obesity, more diabetes, more heart disease?
Yes, I do. When we were coming up, there was more or less two diseases. They call it tuberculosis now, but they call it TB. And rheumatism, which is what they call it, you know, arthritis and all that big name stuff. But that was the two diseases that you had when we were coming up. I remember only one person having cancer when we were coming up.
Are there people with diabetes in your own family?
Yes, my mother had it, my brother, my sister have it, and everybody just about have blood pressure problem. Luckily, I don't have blood pressure, and I don't have sugar. So if it wasn't cancer, I wouldn't have anything. So, but anyway, you know, it's been a wonderful life. And, you know, we raised everything. We went to school. We did carry books. And you got some lesson out, you know, at night, because we didn't have study period at school. We had to open those books and read. And I'll never forget one night I was supposed to have been getting my lesson, and I was just laughing and had gotten a little love letter from a little boy in my class. And Mama just walked around to see what I was laughing about, and as the children say today, I was busted. But, you know, that's the way we come up. And it's altogether different now because nobody shares anything. Children don't respect anybody, themselves and nobody else. And that's the way we were raised.
Thank you, Ms. Flora.
Sure.
The questions have gotten started, so feel free to share thoughts, questions, comments. Those have been great. And the questions we had here, I don't know, we have recorded, we're doing a podcast. And I didn't know if your questions were picked up. I know you asked about the rate of the illness.
Yeah, I want to know, as the lifestyle has changed within Ms. Wilson's family, mm-hmm. has the rate of obesity, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease gone up as they've gone from making their own food to buying food at the local stores?
It has.
Yeah, it has. Okay. Mm-hmm.
I have a question about the projects that were done with the stores within our community. Was there any follow-up with some of the local food stores in an effort to encourage them to carry more fruits and vegetables, and what was the response to that?
Well, I can say with the veggie project, one way to create change would be to work directly with the food stores in the communities rather than setting up something new. At this point in time, we have not worked with the stores in the community, and whether that's good or bad, one of the reasons why is because it's an entrepreneurial opportunity for the kids at the clubs. So what we found is that a lot of people are willing to shop at the markets and actually give tips and extra money at the markets because they're supporting the kids in the Boys and Girls Club. So all of the profits that came from the different farmers markets go right back into the Boys and Girls Clubs. And if we were in the store, it would go to the owner of the store or whatever. And I think it was really important for the kids to have the chance to be able to, you know, build their own entrepreneurial skills, their business skills, and keep the money rather than, you know, lose that money to the local market that a lot of people in the neighborhood didn't think was an asset in the community to begin with.
I had a question about the gleaning project. You said that you surveyed 50 stores around one of the Second Harvest food distribution areas. Which one was that?
I'm sorry. You're talking about a different project. Gleaning was the last project. We actually had 8 different sites in Nashville. So 8 different food box distribution sites, and it was a mile around each of those. I was going to respond to this question, though, and the dialogue that we attempted to have with the stores, and it's the same issue a lot of times with food accessibility, is that they have tried carrying other items, and then people don't buy them. And so it's also that, you know, with the educational side of getting people to want these things and to purchase them once they get in there. And so they'll start carrying an item thinking that you know, we're convinced them it was good for people. But then nobody buys it, and they rot, and they lose their money, and so then they just quit carrying them again. And so we've got to work from both directions, obviously, and get people to want, you know, these items and to purchase them once they get there. The one part we did of that study that I didn't mention was that we kind of assessed whether the food that was there was of good quality or not. And I guess the good news was there wasn't much there, but it didn't appear to be something they were, you know, putting there and leaving forever. Most of it was considered pretty good. You know, bananas rot pretty fast, and I think we see those everywhere. But, that's a real issue we have. And as people will say, like, they want low-fat stuff, or they'll want this, or they want that, but then they don't buy it after the first try. You know, we ask people, for example, in the Gleaning Project, how this has impacted you. And the most interesting one is the eggplant, is that, you know, people are not commonly eating eggplant, but those that did get it and ate it thought they might buy some eggplant after that. So now whether they do or not, you know, we don't know.
Question in the back.
Well, you know, education of the community on how to cook vegetables in a way that makes them taste good should be a part of the curriculum for schools. I think the curriculum doesn't even relate to kids anymore in their daily life, you know. Home economics stuff doesn't even exist anymore. And shop and things that are real and hands-on, and I think that should be part of the new direction that our curriculum planners should take, because if the kids get it, they can pass it on, you know. And it's just such a, it's so easy to cook something tasty, but not if you've never done it.
Right. Fresh vegetables. How to cook it. Of course, Leslie does a lot of that with the community adults. I don't know how much we're doing with children, but
children are easier to actually teach to cook than adults.
And I did want to say one thing with the farmers markets. I mean, one of the things that we're trying to dispel the myth that people in the community aren't willing to pay for the fruits and vegetables, and the farmers markets have been incredibly successful, but you saw the food we had there. This is the best food in our community. And one of the things we heard from people when we did a lot of focus groups in the neighborhood associations and with Boys and Girls Clubs is that if you don't have high quality, don't even bring it here. Don't even look, it's almost like taking, like, whatever you bring here shows what you think of us. And if you bring crap, you think we're crap. And if you bring the best thing in the city to our community, you display to us that you think we're the best thing in the city. And so I think it's really important that when we think about change, that there's not a two-tiered way of thinking about it. So there's the first class and the second class. And if you're in the first class, you get good. And if you're in the second class, you get bad. And I think when we see people who feel that they are second class, it's because sometimes we brought things to people that say, you are second class, you get the leftover, you get the seconds. And I think that if we talk about creating a healthy, just, and sustainable system, it has to be one that treats everybody in the same way. That the tomato that I buy at Whole Foods should be the same kind of tomato that's available at Oni's farm, you know, market and wherever neighborhood in Nashville. And you know what we found with the Veggie Project, which I think is so cool, is by the end of the summer, kids were spending their own money to shop at the farmers markets. And let me tell you, that's a pretty big deal when they have a candy store in the Boys and Girls Clubs where they can buy chips and sodas and whatever. And they came out there and they took their quarter or their 50 cents or dollar and bought peaches and cantaloupes and watermelons. And there was not one kid that worked at the Veggie Project that ever wanted to be compensated for their time and cash. And we exchange cash all the time because that's how people pay for food. Every kid that worked at the market wanted to be paid in fruits or vegetables for their time at the market. And so I think that we have to really be careful and be sure we dispel that myth that some people don't like fruits and vegetables, because I have not met one person in the neighborhoods that look at our markets and say, oh my God, that's disgusting. You know, people may not know what to do with it, but they think it's exciting.
Go ahead, please.
Flora, would you say a little bit about your experiences at the Edgehill Community Garden?
Yes, it has been real nice. You know, we have raised things, and although this past summer, the children, somebody went and vandalized everything, so we didn't get much out of it. After the drought, you know, they just taking care of everything. But we've learned a lot, and I've given a lot of my neighbors some of the vegetables that we raised, and everybody enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to working on it again. And I was telling Mr. Jeffrey downstairs I was going to see if I could get some peanuts, and we could grow some peanuts, maybe popcorn, and let the children see
where it comes from,
that, you know, it didn't come already popped in the bags. See, a lot of children, they don't know. I'll never forget a little girl. She always ate, she loved fish, and she would always get it from K Captain D's, and one of my neighbors went fishing. And that was my kitchen, Miss Brenda, and showed her a fish. And she said, no, fish don't have eyes. You know. She's always seen fish parts. She've never seen a whole fish. And she couldn't believe that's where the fish come from. So it makes a big difference. And again, I forgot to say, when we were coming up, we ate poke all winter, and we didn't have freezer, so we cured that with coarse salt. And you taking it out and soaked it was just as fresh as when you first killed a hog. So it's a lot these children need to be able to go to somebody's farm for a week and see how people live on the farm. It's a lot of fun. You get up early. You have a long day, but you enjoy it at the end of the day. And again, in coming up, we didn't have club. We didn't have fast food. There was no McDonald's or anything. We didn't have all of that. And at night and on the weekend, the men got together, and I think that's where blues come from. They sang about their life in songs. They would just get together with guitars, accordion, and violins. And my brother made a violin out of a cigar box and the hair off a horse's tail. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and they talked, that's how they expressed themselves through music. And anytime you hear some of these old blues, those people have lived what they're singing about. And trust me, it wasn't easy. And as I say, being in the South, in the mixed community, we knew we went here, white people went there. So we got along good. We didn't have problems with that because you knew where to go. When we were walking to school, the children on the bus, that rode the bus, they would spit on us, throw on us. We couldn't do nothing about it. When we saw the bus coming, we knew to try to get a distance away. And, you know, so it's not like that today. When we were coming up, I had never heard the word juvenile. And now that's all you hear about, juvenile. So it have changed a whole lot, because my nieces are telling me, well, you know, this is the 80s, 90s. I don't care what it is. Respect does not change. If you don't respect yourself, you're not going to respect nobody else. And I try to tell these children that don't let these little boys say things to you. Stop them. You don't need that to have a friend. You just let them respect you, because if they don't respect you now, they won't respect you later. So, you know, as I said, everybody should take their children to the country for a week and let them see where things come from and what it's like. It's not going to hurt them.
Any more questions?
The studies, the statistics that you showed were kind of urban focused. Are there corresponding studies for low density rural areas?
I don't have them, do you? But national data would indicate that, I mean, rural communities are, you know, often are very food insecure, even more food insecure in terms of, you know,
accessibility.
Ironically, I mean, even though food is in theory grown in rural communities, it's often not able to stay. In fact, there are a lot of farmers who are getting food stamps themselves because they can't afford the very food that they grow.
But I can understand that. I love grapefruit, but I totally refuse to pay a dollar for a grapefruit because they are 99 cents a pound. Mm. And you're not going to find a grapefruit under a pound. So that's, you know, I consider myself cheap, but that's just the way it is. And especially when you're on a fixed income. Yeah.
I have a related question. In either of the studies that you did you collect any data on the vegetable availability in higher income areas of the city, just to show a comparison?
With our study, we have a new set of data that I don't have it. It would be more diverse. It wouldn't necessarily be only higher income, but we include, like, and it's around YMCAs, and YMCAs tend to be around a wider variety of community members. So one community is Green Hills, and if you just look at Green Hills compared to any of these five communities I talked about, the number of supermarkets alone around Green Hills is more than all five of the communities around the Boys and Girls Clubs.
Yeah.
So not including other markets or restaurants and stuff.
To put together the Green Hills all more than all time ago.
Yeah.
Yes.
Interesting. Do you guys know of any type of strategy or anything that's being done to address that food desert, community deserts, like that really needs to be done? I know that over in the Edge Hill community, we've had like 3 different stores right there on that corner. They come in, they stay a while, and they leave. Now there is no store there except what we call a little dollar store where they sell hair and jewelry. And in the corner, they have eggs for something like $2.50 a dozen, and milk and $2.50 you know. And people across the street in public housing, people get food stamps. They come over and they swipe their cards and they take money off their cards to take home something that's only a fraction of what they should be getting for the amount. They have, they incorporated what they call a pizza thing there in the store where you could actually come in and get a large pizza for $9 and something. So a lot of people bring them, use their food stamps and actually buying those pizzas or buying that high-priced food. So I would like to see something come out of some type of strategy, some brainstorming around addressing the issue of food against communities.
Then another thought is, what could the food store that is in that community do to get people to it? Because it's about spending money, it's economics. And what is that? Supermarket willing to do? If they spend a certain amount of money, can they have a bus to take people back and forth? Because if you can't get rid of the desert, can you make it, was it bring the people to the area? And that's something that needs to be discussed. It could be a discussion that we have left with our supermarket. Didn't they once do that, provide a bus to the area?
They used to, years ago, when the first store first left, we met with MTA and asked them to furnish us a bus at least 3 times a week to pick people up that stayed in the high rise or from public housing or anywhere and take them down to Kroger. And they did that for a while. And then we got another store, so they didn't left. And so now they're not doing that because they were saying that, it wasn't possible.
It wasn't cost-effective. So the supermarket, though, could do it. You know, if people spending $40, which may be a bag or two now.
The problem is there isn't a supermarket.
Actually, there is one down the street off of 8th Avenue South in Kirkwood, isn't it?
Kirkwood, yeah.
Yes.
It's not close, but it's there.
Yeah.
And from Edge Hill to Kroger at 8th and Kirkwood.
Kroger is at
8th. Yeah, Kroger's
yes.
At
8th. Yeah.
Now, it's about 2 miles.
Yeah, it is. I'm saying, so to avoid the accessibility issue, we're saying a mile is not bad to walk, but 2 miles is a little more to walk there and then bring your stuff back. So couldn't Kroger provide? It's been done in other cities, so it's a matter of getting with Kroger and talking to them. I'm sorry?
Rather than a bus, they could even get a van and have somebody do, two trips a day or something. And people could schedule when they could go and get their groceries.
Yeah, so it's something, a conversation that probably needs to be had with that, that Kroger, since it doesn't seem like anything's going to happen. And my question is, Brenda, and on that corner, what happens? I remember when Save-A-Lot was there and then they left. What makes them leave? Why do they leave?
Because one thing was the person who owns the place. He constantly, when it comes time to renew the contract, he would go up.
Okay.
He's a greedy miser. He's a man who just, and we have actually, through OAD, sit down and talk with some people, potential people, to move into that store and got it right up to the wire. And he would say, well, no, I need more money.
So it's sitting empty.
So we've done, yeah, it's been empty a while. And right now they have, somebody's using it as a warehouse. They think we don't know it, but we do.
Which actually isn't legal because on the deed for that property, there is a they call it a codicil that says that it must be used for a grocery store or something that the community approves of.
Yeah.
And the community does not want this storage place there, and no one ever came through the community in relation to that. So it's just people with money find ways to get around letting this in. And like Brenda was said, we came within a week, about 2 years ago, having a grocery store in there.
Yeah.
And one who was going to deliver, and it, you know, it had been a really good one. But then at the very last minute, the owner upped the conditions on the lease, and the man that was going to bring his business there just couldn't afford it.
We also have Harris Teeter on 21st and Blair, but they are very expensive.
Yeah.
Yes. And the people at Lee Rose Apartments, they used to have a bus that would take them to Kroger's once a month. So I don't know whether they still do that or not.
You're going to say, Doctor?
Well, and one thing I, you know, as an example, back to Brenda's question, what can we do? And I think that's part of what this day is about, is what can we do? I mean, so in Louisville, for instance, their public health department has said, we pay for this in our health clinics, in our health care costs and all this. So what they've done in their health department is funding it is in the corner stores. They are paying them to develop marketing strategies to advertise fresh and healthy foods. And they actually subsidize to some extent fresh and healthy foods to be available in the corner stores. And they even, and I think this is brilliant, they are willing to buy back the foods that don't sell because they understand that it's going to be a curve. If I put something new in the store tomorrow and I've never seen it before, I'm not going to buy it. But I might see it, you know, the more it's there, the more I see it, especially if there's samples and ways for me to make sense of that new food. And so the metro government there buys it back. So it's not putting the burden on the store owner. It's not really fair. That store owner, it's not his or her fault that they sell certain kinds of foods. They're about making money. And so this is a way to make a collaboration where a lot of people get a win in this scenario. So that's a project that's going on in a city that's not far away that's very similar to Nashville. And it's, to me, seems like a really innovative way to address some of the corner store issues, to work with corner stores to make change.
It's like a good conversation to have, bringing the people to the table to talk about. Because not just in the Edge Hill community, there's other communities who have grocery store issues also. So it's a,
I just want to say one of the things, I thank you so much, Ms. Flora, for your story. My mother grew up exactly like you did in Michigan, up in Fruit Country, and they did everything that you're talking about. It brought to mind the lack of skill level we have in lots of poor communities. And it seems like, you know, part of today is there is no one answer here. I mean, I'm in James Casey Homes in East Nashville. We have a grocery store. We have a grocery store that does not like black people and extremely hostile to the people that they are serving. I think that, you know, I think it is about teaching skills and education. It is about transportation. I mean, we have a very inefficient metro system here. It would take hours to go downtown to get to the Kroger's that's literally a mile and a half away because you have to go back downtown and then come back into East Nashville. So I really think, you know, we're going to be starting a bakery, community produced bakery at Martha Bryan this next year and looking at other projects around the community. But I do think that as we think about these things, we need to think about kind of triangles of solutions to assist. One of the things we're also looking at is that we have a school bus and we have three vans that run our kids all over the country, quite frankly. But they're not very busy on Friday morning in general. And so one of the things we're looking at is, well, could we just, anybody in the neighborhood that can come to Martha Bryan to get on the bus can go to the farmer's market on Friday morning. That's a fairly low-cost solution, and a little promotion, I think, would make that successful. But I really do think that as we think about these things, it has to be three solutions that somehow work together.
I saw a segment on Cosby Show where they had dented cans, and the children, I think five teenagers got together with the elderly people and boycotted the store for them to have better stuff for them to use. And it was hard work, but they got better results. And, you know, a lot of you go to these stores and they have dented cans, you know, marked down, maybe a dime off. And so, you know, you don't know what you're getting there.
Past date food is what we are struggling with constantly. Mm-hmm. Rotten meat, rotten vegetables, and past date food.
Mm-hmm. Did you?
Like the store, little store up there, you have to really look at the canned goods and the baked goods, because a lot of times that stuff has past date. And people don't realize, oh, I'm getting a bargain, you know, if they put something on sale. Because I have brought ham and Save a Lot or whatever was up there. And now my husband brought it, and he came home, he said, look at this, this is a good bargain. And when he put it in my face, the first thing I spied was past expiration date, 2 or 3 days.
Okay, don't confuse expiration date with past date. That's a whole other conversation, because we need to learn how to understand our dates. They're made for the manufacturer, not for the consumer, so there's a whole different issue there. But I want to thank you all, because now it is 5 minutes till lunchtime, and thank our panelists for being here.